all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Professor Amy Rudenberg. Professor Rudenberg, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we have you on because of a certain research area that you work on and some expertise that you have, and a book that you wrote last year kind of brought this to our attention. But let me set this up. You're a professor at Iowa State University. You have a PhD from the University of Maryland, and you did some work at Harvard Graduate School of Education. And you find yourself with your research focus on the relationship among war, gender, militarization, and American society in the second half of the 20th century. That's a mouthful.
Yep. Yes, it is.
And you wrote a book that the title of is Rough Draft, but more importantly, the subtitle, if you will, is Cold War Military Manpower Policy and the Origins of Vietnam-Era Draft Resistance, that came out last year, published by Cornell University Press. So you have a lot of experience in thinking and writing and researching about the draft. And we're talking because in the last month, as a result of a drone strike and the killing of an Iranian commander, general, this whole issue of the draft and the selective service and how all this works kind of took over the internet, went viral for a few days or weeks. About what do today's young people have to think about in terms of the draft? And so it made it into the New York Times and elsewhere about, will there be a draft? Does this mean we're going to World War III and there's going to be a draft? Well, let's back up a little bit and first talk about the draft. Dr. Rudenberg, how the heck did you get interested in this area?
It was a process, I guess, is the best way to put it. I've always been interested in the question of what makes people serve, going back to watching war movies with my dad as a kid. And I was a teacher outside of New York City at the time of 9/11. And it was a personal attack within my community, which lost members when the World Trade Center fell. I had students who went down and worked as EMTs at Ground Zero. And to my knowledge, no one, except with one exception, joined the military after graduation. And the one exception, he'd always wanted to fly military aircraft, even before 9/11, and that never wavered. And I sort of contrasted that in my head with what happened after Pearl Harbor, when the stories were about how recruitment stations had to stay open for 24 hours and the vast surge of people who joined up. And I was kind of vaguely curious about that. But when I began my PhD program, I had planned to look at women in the military. And I realized, though, in the process of trying to research that without understanding how men were recruited and how men ended up in the military, I couldn't really talk about women. I couldn't do a comparison. And that led me to the draft.
And you've written on this actually quite extensively, both in terms of the volunteer force that came after the draft, but also the draft and deferment policies and sort of the manpower policies of the government during the Cold War and the Vietnam draft era. Talk to us, give us the short history of that, so those veteran radio listeners who may be too young to remember the last draft have some context.
Sure. So the draft was brought back to the United States in 1940. The United States has a long history of enacting conscription during times of conflict and then immediately ending it after the conflict ends and going back down to a much smaller standing force. So the conscription began again in 1940. And it continued with only one short 18-month break in 1947-48 until the end of the Vietnam War in 1973. And so for most of the folks who lived after that point, I think they're aware of a draft during World War II, perhaps the Korean War, and then during Vietnam. But in fact, there was a draft that was active and in place through almost all of those years in between those wars. And so the reason for that, the reason that this was different from what had come before World War I is because of the Cold War, or sorry, World War II was because of the Cold War, where manpower requirements were higher than normal during peacetime, and where there was a worry that there could be a war at any moment, that with nuclear capability, there could be a very serious conflict, you know, at the push of a button. So the U.S. decided to keep a larger force in being, and to do that, they required, or they thought they required, conscription. In reality, except for during the Korean War and the Vietnam War, draft calls were very low, but the draft was kept in place primarily to pressure men into voluntarily enlisting. That if they enlisted voluntarily, they could have some choice over their branch of service and the type of job that they would have and actually the length of time they would be in. And so that sort of added control with the draft hanging over their head pushed men to enlist.
And in some regards, once the system was in place, it was easier to leave it in place because of the challenge of reinstituting it once they removed it. Wasn't that a little bit of the motivation?
Yeah, there was that fear. It also seemed to work. People today sort of at least vaguely, perhaps more, know that the draft during the Vietnam War was inequitable, that working class men tended to be drafted in greater numbers, that men of color were drafted out of proportion to their population in the population as a whole. But all of the pressures that created those inequities, they existed before the Vietnam War. They were part of a deferment structure that was put in place during the Cold War that was left there pretty much because the military didn't need anywhere close to all the men who were coming of age. This was the baby boom generation. They only needed a few, but they felt that keeping that draft in place, because it pressured some men to enlist, it kept manpower numbers up. And it was there in case there was ever an emergency.
Well, a good example of how, you know, there's sort of inertia, and once it's in place, you leave it alone because it's that inertia. It keeps rolling, I suppose, forward, is the draft has ended, and to reinstitute it would take, what, congressional and presidential action of some sort?
Yes. So what exists now is selective service. Registration with Selective Service was reinstituted for men at age 18 in 1980 under the Carter administration. But the Selective Service currently has no authority to actually conscript or draft anyone. So in order for that to happen, there would have to be a law passed, an act of Congress that would be signed by the president.
Well, and again, this is why it's back in the forefront. It's 40 years since registration started back in 1980. 40 years later, the stories, and I'm sure it's fueled by the internet in some regards, like, well, they can start drafting us tomorrow, you know, and this crashes the Selective Service site, as I understand it. But it's no longer a simple process to reinstitute the draft.
No, it wasn't even a simple process to reinstitute registration back in 1980. But I think the fear of young men comes today because they don't understand the system. So many just register with the Selective Service without giving it much thought when they, in many states, apply for driver's license, or if they apply for federal student loan aid, they check a box on the FAFSA form and don't really consider it or give it any thought. And so that general ignorance, I think, combined with a social media campaign that went viral in the wake of Soleimani's killing, it sparked a lot of fear.
Well, and you mentioned a word I want you to back up and talk about, which is manpower requirements, because today's volunteer army and the number of folks in it is drastically different. The manpower requirements are drastically different. So talk a little bit about what that means to maybe young men who have registered and whether or not they should have any fear about the draft being reinstituted.
Well, I think there are two things going on there. One of them is whether or not a draft actually would be reinstituted. And I think that there would be a lot of political pushback against that idea, regardless of what was happening in the world. And so long as the Vietnam generation is with us and their immediate memory is with us, I think that will be the case. But aside from that, if you think about what the purpose of a draft is, it's to raise manpower to fight a conflict or defend the nation. But the nature of the military today and how that fighting and how that defense takes place is very different than it was 50 or 75 years ago. So conscription brings in a lot of bodies to fill uniforms and do jobs. But those jobs, generally speaking, they require training, but not of the technical nature that so many positions today require, which means that the modern military much prefers a force that is voluntary, that wants to be there, that chooses to be there, and that is willing to put in the time to learn the job and learn what it takes in order to defend the nation effectively.
And this really goes to how much technology is now involved in today's military as compared to World War II, where it was grab a gun, learn how to march, and, you know, 100,000 guys are going forward at one time. We just don't see those kinds of military engagements anymore. But many countries, there are countries, I think it's 60 or so, that have a draft or conscription process. You know, it sounds more like North Korea, right? More like Russia or China, where we're just putting everybody in. It's a lot of uniforms. It's a lot of bodies. But it's not the type of military that the U.S. currently has set up.
Yeah, and also the U.S. is big and our population is large. If you look at a country like, for example, Israel, which is relatively small, it does have universal conscription, but it also faces existential threat from its neighbors. So the situation is significantly different from what the United States faces.
As you did your research and writing for Rough Draft, what sort of lessons did you learn that you hope the country learned or will have learned from that Vietnam era draft?
So what I learned is that military service has been used and has been proposed to be used in all kinds of different ways other than national defense, or the way that national defense or national strength through military service are defined has been different at different points in time. So the draft has been used and military service has been used to, for example, offer job skills training or literacy training to those who might need it, or to try to better the economy of the United States, or offer citizenship training and patriotism and some sort of common idea about what citizenship is. And all of those are beneficial goals, but they aren't necessarily achievable within the structure of, say, universal military training or universal service. And that's left me pretty strongly feeling that manpower decisions should be made in light of the defense needs of the nation, how that's defined, and should, generally speaking, be separate from attempts at social engineering to try to make the population something that it is not currently.
And I think that social engineering that you mentioned has impacted all of those areas that in terms of training and education, but it's also been in some ways viewed as, well, this is how we're going to get a bunch of folks from the South to meet a bunch of folks from the North or the West to the East different racial ethnic groups, all of that has been part of that social engineering, I think, the military's engaged in at times. Did you find that?
Although it's so plans for universal military training certainly talked about yanking the hyphen out of America. In other words, if you put all men into this common training, they're going to come into this great big melting pot and learn from each other and become Americans. But at the same time, those proposals were at a time when the military was segregated by race. So I think that there are the military, you know, this is civil military relations. It's a reflection of the society at large. It should reflect the society at large. That means that it is, in my opinion, the role of the military to reflect who we are. That means that it should be open to Black people and white people and women and men and gay people and straight people and transgendered people and cis people. I think that there's room for that. And that in and of itself is not social engineering. It's when you try to wedge the population of the nation into a particular mold that there's room for trouble. I'm not sure if I'm expressing that as clearly as I'd like to be. So
well, I think
tell me what you're not understanding at all.
Well, I think
flesh it out a little bit.
That's a bit where the challenge is, right? If you have a universal draft, then everybody comes in and you shouldn't get deferred for this, that, or the other thing. But that does walk you into the question of, are there segments of society that should not be considered for the draft, women, transgender, gays, whatever it might be. As you went through and looked at what sort of draft deferments were available and how they got used in the Vietnam era, did it teach you any lessons about if you were going to reinstitute this, what would you do or not do about deferments? I didn't say they were going to be simple questions. It's a big question.
It's a very big question that has so many layers. I think we learned from the Vietnam War that privileging one social class over another is a very bad idea. So student deferments, certain kinds of occupational deferments, and this is one of the things that I found, that the occupational deferments that were most given by the time of the Vietnam War were ones that were very specifically designed to support educated middle-class folk, in theory, because these are the people you needed a college education in order to go into scientific and technical and engineering fields, and science was going to win the Cold War, right? We needed the next bomb, the next antibiotic, the next thing that was going to save us from communism. And so it became very class-based. That's not good.
And it
pretty clearly.
Yeah, and it almost seems like any rules you set up, somebody, maybe the lesson has been learned that somebody will figure out how to game the system.
Sure. And I'm not sure that it's possible to not have that problem. But at the same time, we need to ask ourselves conscientious objectors. If people are truly against all war and fighting, should they be required to register for selective service or a draft? What about selective conscientious objection? Honestly, these are big questions that were never settled to everyone's satisfaction during the Vietnam War. It's one of the reasons why the draft ended. These were questions that didn't have good answers, so let's just not ask them anymore. That was part of the rationale for shifting to the all-volunteer force.
But isn't this the time for researchers and deep thinkers to say, what did we learn? And if we had to do this in the future, how would we handle these situations? What sort of policy recommendations would we make? And I guess I'm wondering if the work has just stopped in that area because there really are big thorny issues, and it doesn't look like there's a draft coming back anytime soon, so why bother?
Well, as it happens, there is a congressionally appointed commission, the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service, that has been asking these questions for a couple of years, and its report is due out in March. It will deliver its report to Congress, which will then be free to take or leave its recommendations. But there are questions that are going to have to be answered. What about women, for example? The Supreme Court's rationale for not including women in registration back in the early 80s was the fact that women were not eligible for most combat positions. But that is no longer true, so the Supreme Court's rationale no longer stands. There were also a couple of court opinions that came down quite recently that said that it was not fair to men to only ask men to register. So the question of women is looming. So if we maintain selective service, should women register? But then a different question is, do we even need it? We live in the age of the internet. We live in an age where people can be found if needed. And moreover, the selective service registration system as it exists now is a shell of itself. There are ways that young men exclude themselves from benefits like federal financial aid if they don't register, but no one's getting arrested. No one is sending the Selective Service changes of address when they move, for example, which is something that they're supposed to do. It's not a system that's functioning the way it was meant to in this moment. So I think Congress is going to have to take up the issue, and I imagine it will do so at some point after March 2020 when this report comes out.
Well, it's a very thorny big issue, so I
yes,
doubt anybody.
I don't envy the folks.
No, I doubt anybody will really touch it this year, being an election year. But this whole discussion comes on the heels of this big worry or fear about the reinstitution of the draft and not understanding how that would happen, and sort of a discussion about, well, who is it who volunteers and who is it that fights. The New York Times just recently wrote on this as well, and really finding that, you know, a high percentage of people who volunteer are men and women who either come from the South or communities around military bases, and are more likely than not to be children of veterans and former service members. So this small group who volunteer for the military kind of gets tighter and more insular over time. And again, going back to the work that you did on the whole issue of the Vietnam draft resistance, how do you balance those two things? Maybe one was too large of a system. Is this too small of a system? Is there some middle ground that you see that should be at least talked about?
I wish I had all the answers. I think that we're still casting for them. Conscription, as it existed up until 1973, was inequitable. Military service under the volunteer system that we currently have is also inequitable. They're inequitable in slightly different ways, but they end up having similar effects in that people feel separated from military service in this nation. What the middle ground is, smarter people than me are working on this problem. I would say that it probably has something to do with understanding what the military is. I think that's why the research shows that it runs in families, because people who have family members understand the ins and outs, the benefits as well as the drawbacks of military service in a way that folks who don't have family members who serve, they don't see that as a full picture. I think another piece is probably are our leaders using our military effectively and ethically and respecting the service of the people who give it? Are people being put in harm's way for poor reasons? Are they being taken care of after they're discharged or after they leave service? And those are a lot of big questions with, I think, a lot of room for improvement. And maybe that's part of the answer as well.
Well, we're talking to Professor Amy Rudenberg, who's at Iowa State University in the Department of History, who's written Rough Draft, Cold War Military Manpower Policy, and the Origins of Vietnam-Era Draft Resistance, to give us some thoughts on the draft today with a historical perspective because of the concerns that have popped up in the last month. But it really goes to this larger issue that also involves gender equity and how we use our military. I think you may have summed it up right, Amy, in saying that the draft itself back in the Vietnam era as applied was inequitable, but letting this become that a smaller and smaller group of people defend the United States with in the military is also inequitable, just in a different way. That might be the real answer here. And we look forward maybe to talking to you again back sometime after March when this big national report comes out to see if those smarter people than you, I don't think they are, but if those smarter people than you actually came up with any good ideas or whether they just kicked the can down the road. It'll be interesting to see, won't it?
Yes, it will. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you for taking some time with Veterans Radio today to talk about this subject. It's, you know, sort of one of those ones that's over in the corner of the room, and every now and again, people have to take a peek at it, and when they did recently, it got them really nervous. So hopefully you've calmed them down a little bit, and you've let them know that people are thinking about this issue and that there's multiple ways to make sure this is done efficiently and effectively and fairly. All of those would be good if it ever has to be reinstated.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We're glad that you had time for us today, Amy, and we look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thanks so much.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.